This is Limitless Possibility. I'm Luc-Olivier Dumablet.
And I'm Yannick Marion.
And what's our topic for this week, Yannick?
Our modern computer habits.
Good, but before you start, we have some follow-up.
We sure do. And first piece of follow-up right here is going to be for episode 79, which was called Donald Sutherland. Do you remember what this episode was about?
Was it about Bartender?
Yes, it was.
Oh, yes!
So the reason I'm bringing this up is thanks to a friend of the show, Halsey, for pointing out that there is a new Bartender anime starting in April. Bartender Glass Ooh. Of God is airing on April 4th on TV Tokyo, and it is also licensed for simulcast by Crunchyroll. So I am looking forward to watching that during the month of my birthday. I'm going to be very excited about that. No such thing as too much Bartender, according to me. So that's going to be cool. Next piece of follow-up is for episode 200, Social Media Grief Counselor. Co-host almost went out of business again. So this happens basically every 6 months. So you shouldn't really be surprised by now. But basically, it's the same old story. The staff over at Co-host has repeatedly not prioritized features that enable any kind of monetization. So it kind of doesn't help the site ever get sustainable, and the staff doesn't really want to take any pay cuts to their relatively high salaries to give the site a chance to survive. So I guess the more cynical people are looking at Co-host staff and saying, like, it's almost like they're giving up and they don't really want the site to succeed at all, and they're not really taking any steps to make it sustainable in any particular way. They have managed to secure funding since their latest financial update. Basically, the latest financial update they did that was a regularly scheduled financial update essentially said, like, yeah, the site might just die in 2 weeks. So that was fun. And
wow.
Yeah. And then what happened is what happens every single time. People on Co-host made a bunch of memes, and people started spending money that they don't necessarily have to support the website.
Oh, no.
And everyone is acting like this is a good thing, which is weird. And I really don't get it. I honestly do not have the brain to understand, A, why people like this website to begin with. Like, the mental model of what Co-host is makes no sense to me. Just like Tumblr as a social network never made any sense for me. But B, I don't understand how these users react to literally anything that happens coming from staff on that website. It makes no sense. Like, there are so many red flags and people just keep ignoring them and keep trucking along. It is very concerning. I will link to a nice article by Lori, who is one of the most vocal critics of how Co-host is mismanaged and how they constantly fuck up their finances. So you can go read sort of a breakdown of every single financial update they have ever posted to see that they don't really seem interested in improving their situation at all, which is kind of depressing if you like Co-host. So that's it for me. What do you have as follow-up?
Just before we switch, I kind of forgot, where do they get their money usually? Like, are they VC backed?
No. So this is the weird thing. They have an anonymous rich friend that loans them money.
Okay. And that same anonymous rich friend give them a big fact check again.
Yes. But this is one of the wow. details of the latest regular financial update is they were unable to contact their rich friend for a while. So they were worried they couldn't get more money.
Oh, wow.
It sounds like a meme, but every financial update is kind of like this. So it's very funny. It's also very stupid at the same time.
Can you imagine if it's like somebody like Jack Dorsey that just loves to go on like a yoga retreat or something like that? Nothing against yoga retreat, but like something where you go for like 6 months, you turn off your phone, and it's like, oh yeah, we need money now. It's like, oh, sorry, I was gone for 6 months. Here's some more money.
Yeah. It's very strange. And I think there's a high likelihood that the rich friend is kind of tired of just loaning them more money because they clearly are mismanaging the website and don't know how to deal with making the site sustainable in any particular way. I don't know. It's depressing, man. You want to like the website because, like, on paper, they have the right values for like a small, sustainable, indie social network thing. But then they just fuck everything up in terms of how they manage the website, and it's hard to feel bad for them.
Good. So shifting gears, literally, I will be talking about episode 191, Kind of a Blob. And this is the episode where I was more or less discussing me joining the Subaru family, and also as a more infotainment system nerd. For the past few months, first, I don't know why Tony did that, but one day he kind of realized that we could connect via Wi-Fi the infotainment system of our car, and he did that, and it started to tell us, hey, there is an update. So after he more or less tried to do it himself, and it kind of acted up, which got me worried because I didn't want to go to the dealership to deal with that, I started to do some research about what does the latest update of my infotainment system will bring to me. And I was gladly surprised that one of the features that I was sad to not see in my 2022 model year car, that it didn't get, that it was finally able to get it. So if you go look at the 2020, 2021, and 2022 and compare it to the more recent refresh of the Subaru Outback or the Legacy, I own an Outback Wilderness, they've tweaked some of the HVAC control because, hey, yes, one of my car is one of those cars that it just have, well, doesn't just have a big screen, but the center console is more or less just a big screen. And there was two important things that they fixed in that area. So if you can imagine, like imagine the dock on the iPhone where you have your bottom apps, but in their infotainment system, the HVAC controls or the quick controls acts as a dock, give or take. And they fix two important things. First, for people like me that live in cold climates, I don't need to go through screens to turn on and turn off my heated seats. There is a quick access button on the main screen and always present, and that's super neat. The other one is they did tweak the rest of the controls. For example, the fan speed controls are a bit bigger, so they're a bit easier to hit while you're driving your car on a nice Quebec road that is bumpy as hell. You can hear the sarcasm in that sentence. And at first, that was only announced, like I mentioned, during the 2023 model refresh. The thing I missed after being sad about those news is 6 months after, they did release the update to the older cars. So it allowed me to experience the way to update the Starlink Subaru multimedia software system, which is quite different from my own experience with the Ford Sync system. As you may remember, I own two generation of Ford cars with different syncs system generation. The first one that was considered quote-unquote Sync 2, which was the Microsoft-based version, and then the Sync 3 version that was QNX-based. Both of them, even if the Sync 3 version had over-the-air via Wi-Fi updates, I was living in an apartment, it was always a struggle to get there, I was able to use more or less a USB key to update that. And from my quick searches on the Subaru side, it seems that, yes, you could do it with a USB stick, but to get the more or less the firmware files, it is hidden behind a dealer portal, sadly. I didn't have the time to look at my owner's portal to see if there was able to download it, but at least I put my trust into what they call the FOTA, the firmware over the year software update functionality, which is funny because I'll put two links in the show notes if you are a Subaru owner with this big Starlink 11.6 inch display in your car, the one that more or less gives you the steps to follow from the Subaru website, and second, a website from some random, I think, US dealership salesperson that just more or less shows you the update. On top of that, the other benefit on top of improvements to the HVAC system, the other real thing, it's not a feature, but it's more of a bug fix, is that while we did enjoy the system, we're big CarPlay users, and the main issue we've seen is that at random moments, but in most cases it was after maybe 15, 20 minutes of just us driving, sometimes CarPlay would just randomly disconnect. And guess what? I was able to find a TSB, so a technical service bulletin, from Subaru on some of the Subaru forums, and they were able to provide the list of fixes and new features. And I also realized at that point that my car was two updates behind. So the most recent one that gave me the new HVAC control UI also improved that CarPlay reliability. And it did improve general like infotainment system reliability. And after a week, even if it was a bit frightening, we did it over the air. Sadly, the way my parking lot is positioned compared to my condo, like the Wi-Fi, I can get some Wi-Fi, but it's really weak. Or if you have shitty Wi-Fi antennas, like for example, I was in the car with my work M1 MacBook Pro, and it was working fine, but the car system wouldn't see my Wi-Fi network. So at least in the update steps, Subaru does mention that it takes about 100 megs. To get all the files. So they do suggest that either you get your own home Wi-Fi or you can use more or less tethering to do that. And again, if you have a well-sized data plan, I think 100 meg is plenty to just do that over the phone. And that's more or less what we did. So we ended up burning gas for about, say, 25 minutes. Because you need to leave the car running. And even if I was scared a few times, the over-the-year update did work as advertised, let's put it this way. So yeah, pretty happy about that. I guess I'll have to keep a closer eye to those updates, because this update was already 1 year old, the one we were waiting for. So we could have updated literally a year ago and enjoy more reliable CarPlay, and for sure for this winter, better touch controls for the heated seats. So if you own a more recent Subaru car, or even like maybe a, like I know they have different systems, but if you have like a 2017, 2018, 2019, where they have a small screen, those are also updatable. But my understanding is it's only the more recent ones that have over-the-air functionality, or even the older ones, you might need to go to the dealership to get the update that brings the over-the-air functionality. So ask your dealership or just go on the forums, but be aware they might charge you for the update, which they don't charge you for the update, but they charge you for your time for them to put the update, which to me is totally dumb. But at least mine already had the over-the-air functionality baked in the OS, so at least I was able to do that. And last up on my list of follow-up, it was literally about the previous episode. And as you may remember, I did live during the recording disable the action button. And I would like to report that I did not put back any functionality to it. So it's still disabled. And I was listening to the episode. I was like, oh yeah, I didn't have any accidental triggers. Or if I did, they did nothing. So it was really a nice improvement. But I guess a great way to say that the button is useless, let's put it this way.
Meanwhile, today I accidentally started a 2-hour cool down workout while I was working and stressed out trying to get deliverables out the door. And I realized 2 hours later, I'm like, oh, my rings are full because I've been working out apparently for the past 2 hours.
Hey, yeah, that's fair. But I guess for sure, if you were stressed out trying to build to like ship a release, that's quite the opposite of a cooldown workout.
Yeah, the calorie count was insanely high for a cooldown.
Yeah. So that's it for my follow-up. Let's go into your main topic.
All right, so you heard the topic at the start of the show, modern computing habits. What does that even mean? Good question. It kind of evolved out of a discussion that we were having privately after we were both watching the newest ATP members special. So Accidental Tech Podcast, which is the podcast with John Siracusa, Casey Liss, and Marco Arment. They have a members program where you can pay a certain amount per month to get ad-free episodes and occasional specials. And the latest one is going to be a classic for sure. It is a video special where John Siracusa shares his wacky window management philosophy. If you are familiar with John at all, you know that he is a big advocate for sort of the classic Mac spatial metaphors and whatnot. And he wishes that modern Mac OS was more in that direction, and I'm inclined to agree to certain degrees. And a lot of his window management philosophy that he has teased over the years by just hinting at it in various podcasts is based on those principles. And it was super interesting to listen to, even though I don't necessarily agree with all of it. I think there is a lot of value in hearing how different people decide to use their computers. And when we were talking about that, we were talking about how our own computing habits are and how they compare to, each other's and also John's. And it eventually led to a wider discussion that I thought could make a good topic on the podcast, which is sort of what is the role of a traditional computer, and by that I mean either a desktop or a laptop computer, in our lives today, and how do we use it in practical terms?
Right, and that came when Yannick did mention that more or less he doesn't really use a traditional computer outside of work.
Right, so I guess the first distinction we have to get into is like there are traditional computers and then there's the rest, right? So traditional computers versus computing appliances. I think computing appliances, such as phones and iPads, greatly reduce our overall reliance on traditional computers. In a way that I think we all understand this. We know that we spent time with these devices that are not traditional computers, but I don't think a lot of us have explicitly taken notice of. I would say that ultimately, like, I don't need a traditional computer to live my personal day-to-day life. Obviously, the same can't be said about work, where I spend all day staring at my work laptop, whether it's my work ThinkPad or my work MacBook. But if I look outside of work, I haven't traveled with a laptop in almost a decade, aside from work travel. And when I'm traveling, I always resort to just using my phone and iPad, and I don't really feel like I'm missing out on anything while I'm doing so. And if you look at my spare time when I'm at home, 99% of it is spent on my 12-inch iPad Pro. And since I don't believe in using iPads as bad laptops, I only use it as a tablet.
Oh boy, I won't say I take offense to, saying that, but yeah, I guess you could say that I use my iPad Air as a bad laptop for years at this point.
Yeah, and the point is, like, if I'm going to use something that is a laptop form factor, I'm going to want a real laptop and not a pretend laptop that is limited in a bunch of weird ways. And I do have a real laptop, it just runs Linux, and we'll talk about it later. So because of this, my usage of traditional computers is really limited to when I have a need to use one because something is less well executed on an iPad or a phone. So obvious things would be like capturing game footage for video or streaming to Twitch, which is something I intend to do more of this year. I started streaming more regularly last week, so hopefully I can keep it up. Obviously, recording the podcast, like audio management on iOS, is pretty abysmal. And thanks to the flexibility of macOS and the great people over at, I was going to say Audio Technica, but that is completely wrong. Rogue Amoeba, I don't know why that came to mind.
Did you change your mic and didn't tell me?
No. Okay. Thanks to the great people over at Rogue Amoeba, there's plenty of software on the Mac that really allows us to do basically anything we want with audio. And we don't have that kind of flexibility on iOS, or I'm going to say yet, but at this point, I'm not even sure I should believe that eventually it will be possible on iOS. Doing things like ripping videos from YouTube using scripts like YTDLP, Obviously, software development. I mean, technically, you can use Playgrounds on the iPad to ship apps now. But having, I tried to write a little app, a little toy app in Playgrounds, and it was not particularly enjoyable. So can't really stand by that.
And also, I would even say, wait, you did that on your 12.9, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Because I can tell you on the iPad Air, it is kind of an 11, but not an 11. I think it's like 10 point something. It feels really cramped. And especially the way of Playgrounds, like you want to see, like it's a ripple where you want to see the results of your lines already. Like you kind of have to switch modes all the time.
Yes. And obviously, if you're not using an external keyboard, it's even worse. And speaking of external keyboards, basically anything requiring a lot of typing. Like I said, I don't believe in the whole iPads with keyboards thing. That is not at all how I want to use an iPad. I think it is a worse way to use an iPad than just using it with a touchscreen. So if I'm typing anything of substance, I'm going to reach for either a laptop or go to my desktop and use my favorite keyboard. And to be honest, I used to do more typing on the iPad for a while. But nowadays, I don't bother, mainly because I've gotten over the whole iOS is your main device thing. Like, I use the device that makes the most sense for the task I'm trying to accomplish is basically the thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know what? Okay. I'm not trying to diverge this episode into a photo management app.
Of course.
Episode. But it is one of the key aspects of what I do on my personal computer. And yeah, I'm in the more recent months, I'm kind of embracing the software that are available only on desktop, and their benefits, and kind of letting go of, oh, I need to do that on the iPad, even if I still feel that the iPad as a device is really neat to do that, if and only if it adds more powerful software.
Which is wild because, like, I do all of my photo processing on the iPad only, and I don't remember the last time I used my Mac to do anything regarding photos.
Right. But I didn't mention that I wanted to diverge on why, but again, for the past photo episodes, you've remember scan, like negative scanning and all that fun stuff.
Yes, we have wildly opposing needs in terms of photo management.
Agreed, but I would even say that somebody like you that is only shooting digital can work on their phone even if they want. I know a lot of people in the photo club I'm attending that are just doing that on their phone, and like I can strongly believe that it can be done today. Just that I would even say that even if you have a more professional quote-unquote flow that only recently the tool became available, like I'd say if you are more somebody that would do portrait things like that, like Capture One on iPad seems to be a game changer, but it's shipped like 2 years ago, so before that it would still be you rely on the Mac. I echo your feeling that yes, the iPad sometimes is more or less a bad laptop, that I would be better fulfilled with a real laptop, but a real laptop reminds me of work too much sometimes, so
I get that.
So yeah.
And there's sort of a related point with regards to that, which is like now that I'm using traditional computers less as like something I'm tinkering with and more so like a tool to get specific things done, I have an increased value of desktop OS stability. So for a number of years now, I have been using what some people like to call the GTS release of macOS on my home machine. So GTS is a term that I had heard from the Fedora people. It means grand touring support, and it's kind of the opposite of long-term support. And the idea between grand touring support, it's you prioritize a smooth ride. So it's the latest version, latest major version minus one.
The latest minor version. Okay.
So major version minus one.
Right, so for macOS, it will be macOS 13.
Yes, although, unfortunately, Unfortunately, Apple fucked up this year, and numerous people have had their auto update settings ignored by the operating system and wound up waking up one morning and Sonoma was installed. So that happened to me. And the reason I know it happened to me is because I have a capture card hooked up to this computer that is discontinued and no longer supported. And they have said multiple years ago that they're not going to release software updates for new macOS versions or for Apple Silicon for this particular capture card, which means if I accidentally update my system and the software breaks, I essentially need to go out and buy a new capture card, which is not something I'm particularly interested in doing. So I'm generally pretty cautious about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have dependencies on old versions of software that I am too embarrassed to admit at the moment for various things in my workflow. So generally, I try to be very careful and stay on older versions of macOS for my stuff because I honestly don't really need new features in macOS right now. I'm pretty comfortable with what the OS can do for my needs. And until I'm actually going to be shipping iOS code, I don't really care if I'm on the newest macOS version. I just need shit that I do to keep working. Similarly, on the Linux laptop, I favor Debian-based distributions, especially like right now, my distro choice, like I mentioned on a recent episode, is Linux Mint Debian Edition, which is basically just a thin layer on top of vanilla Debian 12. And Debian has a very conservative approach to software updates within each major version, so things stay incredibly stable but secure.
Compared to other distro, like Debian itself could be considered LTS compared to what other distro do in their day-to-day releases.
Yes, generally Debian major releases have longer support windows than the Ubuntu LTS versions, which is generally the longest of the of the non-enterprise Linux distributions, let's say.
Fair.
This is a complete 180 for me from when I was embracing the Arch Linux rolling release lifestyle when I was in college, where I would install updates every single day and I would have to read release notes every single day and find out which packages I would need to manually intervene and update myself. Fun.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, looking out at the horizon of what's coming up in the Linux world, immutable distributions like Fedora Silverblue, which offer a more iOS-like update model, where the system image is kind of completely segregated from the rest of the system and it's updated in an atomic way, that's a really appealing model, but the only problem I have with it is that it tends to be very intimately linked with which desktop you're using, and the hardware I have right now does not perform particularly well with GNOME, so, and I don't like KDE, so like those two options are, neither of them are really good for me, but like if I could have a desktop that actually performed well on my hardware, I might actually give something like a Fedora Silverblue a shot, because I think the technology is really interesting, and it's not too different from how macOS updates, modern macOS updates on Apple Silicon work.
Where like the root, not the root, but the core of the OS is kind of sealed and everything that you do happens in.
Yeah, it's basically the iOS volume update model where you download an IPSW and then you do a delta update on your system partition. It's very similar to that on Fedora Silverblue. And there's a whole framework called Universal Blue, which actually lets you build custom images, which is really interesting. Like, I love that entire world of Fedora. It's just so much of it is intimately tied with GNOME and KDE right now that it's just not... That's the sticking point for me. The rest of it is really cool. So now that we've talked a little bit about, like, the usage patterns and all that stuff, how do I tangibly use my computer? And I want to start a little bit with a desktop setup. So one of the things that was really interesting about me with John Syracuse's setup is he has a ProDisplay XDR, because of course he does. And ProDisplay XDR is a 32-inch 6K display. I do not have a 32-inch 6K display, but I do have a 32-inch 4K display. It is the Gigabyte M32U IPS gaming monitor, and I like it a lot for gaming. Obviously, it's not like a true Retina display. I'm using like a weird fractional scaled mode on this, which is not ideal, but it looks great So, like, that's fine. Like, there's no visual artifacts that I can tell, so I don't mind it that much. Where I do notice it is in system performance. A lot of things chug visually on this display because I'm trying to render at an insanely high resolution all the time. But that is the display I use. So because of that, there is some similarity in how I just have a lot of screen real estate that I can do whatever I want with John Siracusa. I use a Happy Hacking Keyboard Professional 2, which is an ancient, by this time, Japanese keyboard. It is a 60% keyboard, which means it doesn't have a number pad, it doesn't have arrow keys, it doesn't have like home and page up, page down, any of that. It is literally just a rectangle with no function key row, with escape, numbers, the letters, and your basic modifier keys. I love this keyboard to bits. I would like a new version of this keyboard that maybe does wireless or something like that. But they are extremely expensive, and I spent $300 on this keyboard back in the day, and I'm going to use it until it dies.
Ooh, $300. Oh, boy.
Yes, and it uses Topra switches, which are my favorite. They are the same ones as in the 7-Eleven ATMs in Japan. You either love this keyboard to death and you don't want to use anything else, or you think it's a giant waste of money. It's kind of like Apple products. but I like it a lot. I'm also using an Xtrfy M42 wireless mouse, which is a gamer mouse filled with holes. I call it the Swiss cheese mouse because it is insanely light because it is full of holes. Because of this weird desktop setup, I have no trackpad for multitasking gestures. Also, not having a function key row makes using features like spaces and mission control harder to use regularly. But that's not really an issue, because when you're dealing with a 32-inch display, I just have enough screen real estate to spread my things out if I need to. I don't really have a need to switch between multiple workspaces because I just always have plenty of space. Even now, like, I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 windows open on my desktop right now, and I still have room for more shit. So it's like, it's not an issue. And I think I mentioned on the, I think it was on the BOS episode, like, I miss this era of computing we used to have where applications were not expected to take over the full screen of like a 15-inch laptop. And like, you could still have applications with like small discrete windows that could be positioned anywhere and all of that stuff. So similarly to John Siracusa, like, there are lots of applications where I have a certain aspect ratio in mind that I want for certain windows. Like when I'm looking at show notes, whether I'm looking at them in Vim or I'm looking at them in Bike, which is a outliner I use sometimes, I shape it vaguely the size of an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper just because it feels good and I have plenty of real estate to be able to do that on this display. In fact, I could probably just overlay an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper on top of this window, and it would probably be exactly the right size. So that's cool. Because I generally come to the computer to execute a particular task, I don't really multitask as much as I traditionally did maybe like 15 years ago or 20 years ago. Because I think one of the things that has changed because of computing appliances is, previously, if you wanted to be connected with your friends, like when I was in high school or whatever, you had to sit in front of the computer to be available to your friends. Like, we don't really think about that today, but if you were on MSN Messenger or AIM or whatever, you would sit down in front of your computer, and that was when you were available to be with your friends. Nowadays, like, I can go to the grocery store and I can continue a conversation with the creative team whenever I want, because I just have line on my phone and I can talk to people wherever I am. It's not an issue. I can go to Japan and I can continue pretending to live here with a 13-hour delay, right? So that ubiquitous connection and communication with other people means that I have a lot less of an excuse to just sit in front of my computer to be available for other people. I can just sit down on my computer, do my thing, and then when I'm done with my thing, put the computer back to sleep and then go do other shit, and I'm still connected with everyone. I don't have to spend all of my life in front of the computer. And I think there's certainly times when I'm like, okay, now I want to dick around on the computer. I'm going to go sit in front of the computer and dick around for a while with no particular goal. But it's much less common than it used to be when there was also like the secondary goal of, oh, and I'm going to go talk with my friends. So I think like that is one of the big cultural changes in the last 15 to 20 years with the advent of smartphones and all of that stuff that has really changed how I use my computer that I never really thought about until I started working on this episode. So that's how I use the desktop. Now I want to talk a little bit about the laptop setup. Because I'm a weirdo. My previous boss at my job used to remind me a lot that I am a weirdo. So I'm the kind of weirdo who works right off the laptop display, keyboard, and trackpad. And my justification for this is pretty simple. The laptop display is going to be better than most of the displays I'm going to plug into it, right? So, like, I like Retina displays. Our office doesn't have any 4K or vaguely resembling Retina displays. So no way that I'm downgrading my experience by plugging that into an external display. Sure, I could use an external keyboard or an external mouse or keyboard or trackpad or whatever. But the ones on the MacBook are very good. I'm using a recent MacBook, so it does not have the butterfly keyboard. Thank God. My previous did.
You have an Apple Silicon laptop now?
Yeah, I'm on an M2 Pro MacBook Pro.
Oh, wow. Even better than my work laptop.
Yeah. So I just use those. I'm very satisfied with it. I am used to working on a single display. As I mentioned, like on my desktop, I have a single display. So I don't mind that I don't have the full battle station with the three displays going at all times. I don't like docking stations. I don't like external displays, even in the office. So that's how I work. So on my work MacBook, I make heavy use of full screen apps. And full screen apps are so good that I don't really use spaces at all anymore. So from left to right, my spaces, if I go in like mission control or whatever, on a typical work day is the normal desktop space on the left. Then I have Firefox. I have Neovide, which is a NeoVim wrapper. iTerm, Slack, Mail, Calendar, and then Scissora on the complete right. So like you can sort of tell that there are like little themes going on there, Firefox being the browser, obviously. Then Neovide and iTerm is like development. Then Slack, Mail, Calendar is like work communication. And then Scissora is just like controlling my music in the background.
Right. But all of those are, excuse me for the interruption, but all of those are full screen apps.
Yes.
So you use spaces just to manage one desktop and a bunch of full screen apps.
Yeah, well, I use mission control to swap between them. But like as it is, I only have a single space because it's very rare that I actually do something that requires a window that is not full screen, given the screen real estate I have. Because generally, if I'm working with source code, I like it to take my whole screen. If I'm working in a terminal, I like it to take my full screen. And then like Slack, Mail, Calendar, and Firefox, those are kind of applications that at the screen size I'm working with, so I have a 16-inch. Actually, do I have a 16-inch? No, I have a 14-inch, sorry.
Oh, okay. Okay. It's funny you asked this to me, and I've never seen your work laptop, so...
No, I was asking myself. I have a 14-inch, but still, like 14-inch, like it is pretty good. But it's not big enough that I can realistically like have two windows up with like a browser or whatever. So generally, I just like having those full screen. And then Scissora runs fine in a window, but like it just feels weird to have it be the only thing on my desktop space. And also, I added new columns that go off to the right of the screen. And I like seeing my new features. So if I run it full screen, I always see the play count and the skip count and the last played date columns. And it makes me feel good about implementing those features. So that's why I run it full screen.
Hey, that's a good benefit.
Yeah. So that's pretty much how I always do it on my MacBook. And I am pretty strict about keeping things in those orders because I have the muscle memory of swiping so many times on the trackpad to get to the app that I want, or just mission control, drag the cursor to where it needs to be and then get to the right app. on my Linux laptop, where I don't have to keep as many things open for just work monitoring, I generally just survive with three fixed workspaces. So generally, like, my first one is Firefox, second one is Terminal, and then the third one is just, like, whatever else I'm doing. Like, generally, I'm either in Firefox or Terminal, but if I have, like, file management to do in the file manager or whatever, it'll be on the third space or whatever. One thing that is particularly notable is that my Use ThinkPad that I use has 1366 by 768 screen resolution, which is an absolute pain. So screen resolution is at a premium to begin with, so I am more dependent on switching between spaces here than I would be on the 14-inch MacBook. Some people may be surprised to hear that I don't use a tiling window manager, and I have used tiling window managers on Linux in the past. Honestly, I'm not opposed to ever using them at some other time, though there are limited options on modern Linux that use Wayland, which is the modern graphics stack, which is what I'm particularly interested in using if I'm going to be using one of these. And there's just a lot of new Linux stuff that is poorly integrated into these kinds of environments. Nowadays, a lot of the exciting development is happening around desktop environments. So you kind of want to have something like a Cinnamon or a GNOME or a KDE on your system instead of a tiling window manager if you want to benefit from those value adds that have come up in the last decade or so. So that's kind of what I do.
Most recent version of either GNOME or even Cinnamon, or I'm pretty sure about Cinnamon and GNOME, so I won't say KDE, but they more or less have a spaces equivalent.
And oh, basically offers any window manager that has been done since, like, in the last 20 years has workspaces on Linux. Like, that is not an issue. Right, they have had the concept much longer than the Mac has and then Windows has.
Yeah, but I was also to say that they add some limited tiling functionalities too.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Like, I can do a Windows key up on Cinnamon, and it does exactly the same thing as Windows key up on Windows, which is it maximizes.
Right.
And you can do left and right to have it on the left half and the right half of the screen. Right. GNOME which has Mac richer OS support, and especially on Ubuntu, there are additional extensions that are installed by default that improves the tiling behavior. KDE just recently launched their advanced tiling features in KDE 6, which just came out like last week, I want to say. And yeah, there's just generally a bunch of other tiling options if you're really into that. So how do you use your computer? Because I pretty much went over all of my stuff. You've been staying pretty quiet. Yes. What's going on with you?
Yeah, I've been staying pretty quiet because I would like to say that I have a system that is a non-system. I won't talk too much about the laptop that was my Windows laptop that is now a Linux laptop. Again, I've not been using this one too much in the past 6 months. And even then, I don't. When I do things on it, there are specific tasks, whether it was like, oh, I want to dig around on Windows for a specific purpose, or it's like some games or photo management. Whereas my other computers might have more multiple open tasks at once. So I think we'll just more or less tackle my personal stuff first and then go to work. But again, I've been using more or less Mac since Yannick and I have met each other. More recently, I've owned my first Mac in 2008. The idea of why I bring those details up is I think I fit into the case or the description that John has mentioned in multiple of his window management episode, is depending on when you got introduced to a specific OS, you usually use the, or you build habits around the window management functionality of said OS when you start building those habits. And for me, was around Mac OS X Leopard, which was the one that introduced Spaces. So I'm a big user of Spaces. So currently, I'm in front of my personal iMac, and I have literally six spaces and two full screen apps. if I turn next to me by talking a bit off mic and bring my work laptop and look at my spaces, again, today I work from the office, so my spaces are a bit all over the place. I have 5 spaces and 3 full screen apps. So all of this is to say is I'm a big user of spaces. What happens in them, you might ask? A bunch of everything. And that's why I say there's no real system to my system. I take advantage of spaces to group windows together. So they might have a team, they might not have a team, but usually I try to focus them per task, especially on my more personal computer, which I would might want to spend an hour or two doing one specific task, leave it open, knowing I have to do, or I'm tired of doing that, and then I want to go back to it, or a few other things like that. So for example, I have Photos.app open as full screen. I have Lightroom in one, Lightroom CC open in one, and I have Lightroom Classic. We don't talk about why I have Lightroom Classic in this episode open in another space. Also, I have a few Safari windows on a specific space, and a few numbers spreadsheet in another one, and for sure my main desktop or space one, I would say, is currently showing all the windows regarding to our recording of the podcast. So as you can find from the description, is those current spaces are per task. If I contrast that to what I usually do on my work laptop, usually I tend to be a bit closer to what you do, Yannick, where your space one is kind of like your general desktop. I might have a few things on other spaces on the side, but because I usually have a Thunderbolt display to connect my laptop to it, I tend to have a lot of windows open at the same time. So it does mean that a lot of the spaces sometimes has a lot of content in it. And at some point when I feel overwhelmed by all of this, because I just ordered windows, I will spend maybe 5-10 minutes and just cleaning up, moving things to, okay, I'll put it in another space for the needs of, okay, I know that this task needs to happen later down this week, but I don't want to close the thing, those windows, because yay, RAM. We have a lot of RAM, I can use it. That happens a lot. I do still keep a few full screen app open. I'm not usually a full screen Xcode person. I do tend to like it as a window that is more or less maximized, but not full screen. But I usually have a lot of other tools running at the same time, especially for our work needs, or programming needs at work. What surprisingly enough, one of the full screen app, which is rare that it is full screen on my work laptop, is the Charles Proxy application. So sometimes you want to see the log, your network traffic, excuse me. Then I would look at that. So I do tend to have a good mix of just a bunch of windows, but they don't have a system either. They're just a bunch of window on my screen, which was interesting because I kind of start to feel that maybe I say that reflecting on my window usage and seeing what people say about classic macOS, but I do feel that possibly having a way to trigger all the window or to bring frontmost all the windows of an app by one click, or by just like using the command tab switcher, seems quite interesting. I think if it is one thing that I took of this whole ATP member special, was that maybe is it front and center? I forgot if it's switch class or front and center that does that.
No, front and center is the app that adds that behavior, and then switch class is his application switcher.
Right, which is okay. That is maybe something I might be trying to do, but I think it's paid, right, this app? So yep. Trying to get a paid license from work is going to be a mess, but I digress. all of this is to say is I've been an avid Spaces user mixed with somebody that had access to big screens for a long time, that I more or less end up with Spaces are a way to hide some windows that I don't need for today or for now. So I'll just drag them to another space, but end up with a bunch of windows, whether they're tiled correctly or they're just tiled manually and they have a lot of overlap. That is more or less me. I have used multiple displays in the past, which is kind of why I end up with two Thunderbolt display at work. But for years at this point, I really like the focus of one big screen, and you use software feature to create focus points, more or less. Like the spaces to me are that. And even nowadays, because of my semi-temporary, or because I just go to the work once a week, I go in the office. It's the only moment where I use Thunderbolt display and the internal display of my laptop at the same time, and I'm usually kind of lost, meaning that I would more or less put a lot of the windows in the big screen, especially Xcode and a few development tools, and then my internal screen is more or less my own setup, but just in the internal screen, and that's it. So I do like the benefit of using the space, the area of a big screen, quote unquote space, of big screens, because I am a big proponent also of having a shit ton of windows. But sometimes I do clean them up.
Oh, that's one thing that I forgot to mention about my laptop setup. One of the reasons I don't like plugging into external displays is that essentially the way I would manage my windows and my screens would be different if I had access to multiple displays than it would be if I were only using my laptop, and having to switch between those two systems constantly would drive me crazier than just using one system consistently.
I was doing that a lot in the past because I like to enjoy the benefit of laptops. In the, I would say, maybe recent year, I also have in my home office both the iMac and my Thunderbolt display, and they more or less overlap. Like currently I'm speaking in front of the iMac, but the Thunderbolt display is not set up to be configured with it. It's literally right behind it on my raised shelf. So while it is nice to have two quote-unquote big screens, having two big screens that I don't use at the same time means that in weeks that I know that I won't need my office too much, or that I have to change my office setup for maybe two or three times during the week, I kind of become lazy. So for example, for other reasons, this week I was in the office on Monday, and I was in the office on Thursday today. So Tuesday and Wednesday, I kind of worked everywhere and nowhere in the apartment, just on my work laptop, and just enjoy having a laptop. I wouldn't do that daily, to be honest. Even I had moments where I would maybe do a full week and things like that. Like at some point, I do still feel cramped. And I think that changing the resolution on the display itself would help. But a bit like you mentioned, I really enjoy the Retina displays. So I don't mind to use an old Thunderbolt display because I know what I get. But when I can get Retina, I kind of want to keep getting Retina. I don't want to get a 1.5x or a smaller, doubling, not a smaller, why am I blinking on the name? of scaling factor of the display. And usually, I don't think I tried it with the M1 Pro MacBook Pro, but at least with the Intel ones, I always found that with the, I think that's fixed since the 16-inch MacBook Pro introduction, even on the Intel models. But on the 15-inch, I always found that the Retina resolution is just a little bit too cramped, even if you add a 15-inch. And then if you use the more space resolution, and I don't remember what's the exact resolution because it always change per laptop, I always felt it was just a little bit too small, even if I have great vision. So with the introduction of the 16-inch, I always felt that, okay, you know what, like the kind of made it a bit better for the Retina sizing. But yes, I kind of wish I had more space. And I think that's the, not the main downside, but yeah, I think it's the main downsides of having an habit of having one big dedicated screen is you get used to the area available from it. So going back to laptops sometime is hard.
They should bring back the 17-inch PowerBook G4. That's all I have to say.
You know what? I never seen those in person, but
they're massive, man.
Friends and colleagues that add them complain about their size. Yeah. But one thing they mention is, but boy, was it fun to work on this big of a screen.
Yeah.
And I think it was my good friend Bertrand that was saying that, that when they introduced a 16-inch, they were like, you know what? Like they fixed the laptop is massive, but we do get the space back. So I kind of wonder what they would be able to do in the footprint of an old 17-inch laptop, but with like tiny bezels and things like that. They would end up with like a 20-21-inch screen on a laptop. That would be somewhat crazy. And I guess that could be my own equivalent of having a traditional or typical gaming laptop. I was like, I don't want a big fan of a big tech laptop. I just want one that is that has a big screen. And that would be pretty neat.
Yeah.
Last but not least, there's another good benefit of having external screens, even on laptop, is ergonomics. Hey, it's good for your neck. It's good for your back, upper and lower, and you don't get sore, and hopefully you won't feel like you're 70 at 35 because you're sitting on your arse all the time and having bad posture. So if there's yet another benefit is the big screens, in theory, because they're big, they have a higher chance of it being at eye level without having you to be cramped in front of display that is attached to the keyboard that is close to your hands, possibly also close to your lap, which this is something that also when I spend time enjoying the laptop, I do feel some crampedness in my neck for sure. It's like, oh yeah, I felt that I spent the last 8 hours like just literally looking down.
Yeah, I think when I use it at work, it's, well, even when I use it at home, I think I have a pretty good setup where it's not particularly annoying, and I get up and walk a lot too, so that also helps.
That also helps for sure. I am a bit surprised that you're not judging me judging my spaces usage.
I mean, everyone's gonna have a different system and it's gonna work for them, and I'm not one to go tell people they're using spaces wrong.
Fair. You're usually the one saying that you do something wrong, but hey, okay, I'll take that.
Yeah. The other thing is, like, I'm just really interested in hearing how people use their systems, because I think there is a lot of personal flavor that is going to go into everyone's different system. And I think, like, sometimes I see stuff, like, I'm a big fan of the website Desktops, desto.ps. Where people can just upload screenshots of whatever their desktop is at the moment. And there are so many wacky, mostly on Linux, let's be honest, window managers and desktop environments that people use. And it's fascinating to see people use them in novel ways. One of the ones that stood out to me in the last year was there's a user called Mycophobia who uses Mate, which is essentially, if you're not familiar with Linux, GNOME 2 is basically like what old Ubuntu up until like 2011 used to use. And it's probably the most iconic Linux desktop there has ever been. If you used Ubuntu back before 2010, you have no doubt used GNOME 2 before. And Mate is just the spiritual successor to GNOME 2. It's literally a fork of GNOME 2 when GNOME 3 came out and decided to rip off Apple. So it's a continuation of that desktop metaphor. And Mycophobia basically took that and invented the most spatial desktop metaphor you could ever do it by tweaking the configuration to bits. And I'll link one of the posts that they wrote on how to set up a system like this. And it's very Syracuse-esque. In fact, they even refer to an article by John Syracuse in their own post on how they use their desktop. And when I was watching the ATP member special, like that post came to mind because it's absolutely insane. And you're going to think like there's way too many windows on the screen. They don't have like a menu bar or a dock or anything to launch applications. They launch everything from the applications folder, which is not a notion that exists in traditional Linux, but they made one. So there's lots of weird stuff, which is inspired by the classic Mac that just got integrated into their setup. And I found that fascinating, even though it's kind of not at all how I would probably choose to use my system. Although like I'd be game for trying it a couple of days, but I'm not sure I would stick with it. Like whenever I see weird setups like that, I just like putting myself temporarily in their mind and being like, how would it be like to use this kind of setup, and think if there are any ways that I could improve my personal setup so that it works better for me. Most of the time it doesn't, but it's still a fun exercise to do every once in a while. And also yeah. I get to look at very aesthetically pleasing desktops from time to time.
Yeah, and this reminds me something we discussed and you brought up in our kind of private chat about this, was that usually you don't find anything new that is of value for your own workflow, but once in a little while you're like, I learned something new. I was not aware of doing it this way, or I was not aware of this more recent feature in the OS that allows this, or this new app, and you learn something that could possibly improve your own workflow. Again, feel free to interrupt me. I don't want to misquote you, but you were more or less saying, hey, usually it's nothing like jarring or like workflow bending, changing, something like that. But you do find a few important or few nice nuggets by just like surfing or listening to what others has to say about their own workflows.
Yeah, like 2 to 3 times a year, I'll just discover a new app in someone's screenshot and be like, oh, this app is really cool. I want to use that. And it's a good way of finding out about that kind of stuff that is already like integrated into other people's setups. I think it's a really cool way of learning about new things. And yeah, it's like seeing pictures of people's apartments, except it's their computing life.
Oh, no, I'm that we kind won't of do that next. Just before you ask, we don't do that next. Oh, yeah, or even just do our own like physical desktop. Like my poor desk is a big mess right now.
Well, that's a whole thing. I don't even have a desk, but let's not get into that.
Oh, boy.
But that's it for me.
Good. You can find the show notes for this episode at limitlesspossibility.net/224. So 224. You can find our complete back catalog of episodes at limitlesspossibility.net. The show is on the Fediverse. We are at limipo_podcast at mastodon.social. You can also find us individually there. I am at luco at mastodon.social, and you can find Yannick at
Sakarina at icosahedron.website.
We'll see you in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks.